Marriage is supposed to be a bond built on love and trust, but for one couple, it turned into a nightmare. Their story began like countless others. They met, fell in love, started a family, and had some really great years. But then it was marked with the struggles of a failing marriage. One fateful February day in 2023 in Quincy, Illinois, secrets began unraveling, exposing a very unsettling truth. All was not as it seemed. As the authorities delved into the sinister web of lies, they couldn't ignore the glaring suspicion that hovered over one particular suspect. What set this case apart from the rest is a shocking twist. An eerie statement caught on video. Was it foreshadowing or a coincidence? It's a rare glimpse into the mind of a prime murder suspect and a chilling revelation that leaves us all questioning the depth of human relationships. How well can you really know someone? Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is our fourth episode of the Dark Liberty Podcast. I'm your host, Kimberlea, and I'm joined by my co-host and soulmate, Jonathan.
Hi.
Also, don't forget to subscribe, and thank you to all that have.
Yeah, hit that like and notification bell.
Because you never know when we're going to post. If this is your first time here and you've never seen our faces before, it's nice to finally meet you. I do have a main true crime channel here on YouTube, and many of you are now loyal viewers and listeners on both of these channels, so thank you so very much. We're very glad you're here. If you're new, I will link my main channel in the cards and in the description box below. By the way, don't know if you noticed, he's revived. And we do want to thank Debbie for her super thanks in lieu of flowers for the Lava Lamp family. That was really sweet of you, and we were able to get new bulbs, so we really do appreciate it. Back to life once again.
He's
looking good. He is. Very nostalgic. If you didn't know, this set is actually my 90s bedroom. In case you're wondering, it was inspired by
the 90s.
It was inspired by the time I got into true crime with my grandmother at the time. She passed away, but she's the one that started me on the O.J. Simpson trial. We wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for her.
We hope you guys got a chance to check out episode 3.
Thank you for all the feedback.
Yeah, thanks everybody.
Dark Livity is a word created specifically for this podcast. It's the dark downward slope into the depravity of the human mind and the consequences such darkness brings to light. That's what we'll be talking about in these episodes. And today we're going to be introducing you to Rebecca Bernadette Postol. She was born on November 19th, 1981 to Father William and Mother Bernadette Postol in Quincy, Illinois.
I just wanted to pause. This is editing Kimber, and I want to apologize. I've been saying their last name incorrectly. It is actually Postol, not Postol. I apologize. Please forgive me. I try to get these things right, but sometimes I don't.
Rebecca, whom everyone called Becky, had one sibling, an older sister named Sarah, and they were very close considering they were only 16 months apart. The girls grew up on farmland and lots of it. Their father was a town pharmacist and their mother was a stay-at-home mom. Growing up, both family and school were a big part of Becky's strong Catholic upbringing. Becky was extremely close with her family. It was an idyllic childhood and Becky realized she was very fortunate to experience it. Quincy, Illinois is nestled along the banks of the Mississippi River. It exudes a charm that's as timeless as the river itself. With its rich history, vibrant culture, and abundance of outdoor activities, Quincy offers the perfect setting for those seeking a tranquil, yet fulfilling, active lifestyle. The Postols lived on a lot of land in an area that some might describe as the middle of nowhere. It was just pastures and farmland for as far as the eye could see. It was about a 25-minute drive to get into town, and it was a very small town at that. Once Becky and her sister were school-aged, their mother went back to work as a substitute teacher. Academics were an important part of Becky's life, and it was something that she excelled at. She was the valedictorian of her graduating class at Quincy Notre Dame High School, and she was eager to pursue her passion for science. Becky set her sights on Quincy University in the small town she grew up in. Despite obtaining numerous scholarships to attend out-of-state colleges, she couldn't imagine living far away from home. With her close family bond in mind, she decided to stay local for college. She knew she could excel anywhere, and she was right. She graduated summa cum laude from Quincy University with a bachelor's degree in biological science and a minor in chemistry, She was following in her father's footsteps. After graduation, she began working as a pharmaceutical rep for Sanofi Aventis, and that is a multinational pharmaceutical company headquartered in France. It's one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. Almost immediately, Becky was the top salesperson. She won awards and she broke sales records. Despite her professional success, she knew that something was missing in her life. That missing piece was her desire to have a family of her own someday. While attending Quincy University, she did meet a guy by the name of Timothy Bleefnik. He was also from right there in Quincy, like Becky and her family. He was one of three boys. He had an older brother, Theodore, and a younger brother, Thomas. Their mother, Amy, was working as the president and CEO of Macon Resources, and their father, Ray Bleefnik, worked as a sales consultant in Decatur, Illinois. Tim was also a Quincy University Hall of Fame football player and an amateur actor in the local theater group. Becky was athletic, she played tennis, and she thought that Tim was handsome and popular. So the two kept in touch as they attended the university together. Following graduation, they began dating, and they quickly fell in love. And from the start, Becky dreamed of a future with Tim by her side. Tim felt the same way about Becky. They made a gorgeous couple with Becky's naturally light blonde hair and big blue eyes, and Tim's dark hair and light eyes. Both had big, bright, friendly smiles. They were a picture-perfect couple, and the two got engaged the day after Christmas in 2008, and then on September 18, 2009, in just under a year, they were married, 2 years after they graduated from college. Tim was offered a job out of state, and the two briefly moved to Indiana while Tim worked as a recycling broker. Now, I had no idea what that was, so John looked it up.
A recycling broker? Okay, so let's say that you have a company that generates recyclable material, and there's a recycling center down the road. The broker will handle the logistics of getting your materials to the buyer, as well as negotiating the best price for you.
It's fascinating that there are so many jobs out there that I have no idea about.
Despite Becky's success with Sanofi's Indiana office, what she really wanted to do was start a family. A few years after moving to Indiana, they returned to the hometown of Quincy, Illinois. Right away, they bought a house and started the family they both always longed to have. And guess what? Their home was on the same street as Tim's parents, actually about a minute away.
That's convenient, but it also can be stressful to have your parent-in-laws right near you.
Yeah, I
hear
that.
But I guess if you're starting a family.
Exactly. Somebody there to take care of the kids if you don't have a nanny.
Exactly, a canary. Tim and Becky's home was absolutely gorgeous. It was a full brick home with nearly a quarter acre of land in the heart of Quincy. It had four bedrooms, five full bathrooms, and it featured a lovely sunroom that looked out onto a beautiful and private backyard with a 50-foot deck. It had an attached garage and lots of space for a growing family in a very cozy and safe neighborhood. It was actually one of the biggest homes on their street. The Bleefnik's first son, Deacon, was born in 2010, and their second son, Grayson, was born in 2012. Before their first child was born, Becky had quit her career in pharmaceuticals and she became a stay-at-home mom, while Tim still worked in the recycling industry. Not long after Grayson was born, Tim and Becky, both former college athletes, decided to partner with their friends, Andy and Katie Tape, another married couple in the area, and opened a CrossFit gym. And it wasn't just any gym. It was a faith-based community dedicated to being a Christian facility that seeks to honor God by impacting the lives of their employees, members, and the community, according to their website. Now, faith was a central part of the Bleefnik's lifestyle. Both Tim and Becky were active parents and working hard and working out as well, with Tim being a coach at the gym, competing from time to time in CrossFit games, and Becky and little Deacon and Grayson watching from the sidelines at the Illinois State Fair, which Tim's mother, Amy, actually helped put on in 2013. They were very involved in their community. And Becky loved her boys so much, she would post their milestones on Facebook all the time, everything from their checkups at the doctor's office to birthdays and memorable moments like their very first steps. Everything was important to her. There were whole posts dedicated to phrases that one of the boys would say and funny things they would do and interactions that she thought were worth documenting.
Most of her posts were about the boys and not really about herself, but she would congratulate her husband and celebrate things like their anniversary. On September 18th, 2013, she wrote, quote, "Happy anniversary to husband. 4 years, two kids, and one gym later, and I would say we've got a pretty good thing going. Smiley face. Love you, babe. Glad to have you by my side." End quote. Despite being content with her life, Becky harbored a deep desire to contribute directly to the medical field and make a meaningful impact on lives. Becky always envisioned herself working hands-on in the medical profession. So it was no surprise when she left her pharmaceutical career for another career in nursing, which she said was her true calling. She wanted to be able to provide care and comfort to people on a daily basis. So she enrolled at Blessing Raymond College of Nursing and Health Sciences in Quincy, not too far from their home. Wanting to serve people was more about Becky's faith than just going into a profession. She and her family attended the Catholic Church of St. Peter, where their pastor, Father Leo Enlow, stated that Becky probably, quote, considered it a ministry rather than just a profession. She put her own personal self into it, and I think that says something about her and putting her own faith into action in the ministry of healing, end quote.
While going to school and working at the gym, Becky reveled in being a boy mom, and her children were her top priority. She was extremely involved in their interests, which included sports and academics. She volunteered at their school, St. Peter's Grade School Association, and the school described her as, quote, their best asset, end quote. Becky didn't just volunteer. She also coordinated most of the volunteering. She was always willing to pitch in and help whenever she was needed. Each year, she coordinated the Mother-Son School fundraiser event and the annual school Olympics. She planned teacher conference luncheons and helped coordinate the other schoolroom moms. She was like a supermom, and on top of all that, she was also an animal lover, which I can definitely get on board with. She had an incredible love for all animals and passed that on to her children. In addition to all of her volunteer work at the children's school, she still found time for outside volunteering as well. She wanted to instill her love for animals and give back to her children. So she volunteered at the Homeward Bound Wagon, which was a nonprofit all-volunteer animal rescue group doing admin work and fostering animals. I do not know how she found the time and the energy, so I commend her for all that she was involved in.
Right. I mean, you and I are so busy, what, with Shyla, the studio.
Exactly.
And now this channel.
It's exhausting, but it's worth it, and I'm sure she felt the same way, because those are your passions.
Absolutely.
I thought her Halloween costumes in 2013 with Tim and the boys were very clever and cute. Grayson went as a lion, Deacon was a tiger, and both Tim and Becky wore jerseys for their favorite football team, the Chicago Bears. Do you get it?
Mm-hmm.
Lion, tiger, and bears. She posted a little joke on her Facebook saying, "Lions and tigers and Chicago Bears, oh my." I thought it was very cute and creative, and she told her friends and family that little Deacon, for the last 2 weeks before Halloween, has, quote, worn or wanted to wear his costume every day until today, which was Halloween. She said when she tells him he gets to wear it, he has an epic meltdown because he doesn't want to wear it. So he was in a foul mood from the get-go. But I did tell him that only fully dressed tigers get candy, so he begrudgingly put on his costume, end quote. Kids are so funny like that.
I know. I can't wait till we have one of our own.
Maybe someday. The following year, on Becky's 33rd birthday, she posted this to Facebook, quote, "My kids and my husband are asleep. All are healthy. My oldest wished me a happy 20th birthday and thanked me for being his mommy. Yep, he was officially my favorite child today. Hee-hee. When I got home this evening, my youngest ran to the door and greeted me with such enthusiasm and hugs. It's like I was gone for a year instead of an hour. I have a wonderful husband who says he married out of his league, but I think I'm the one who snagged a good one. I had so many of you wish me a happy birthday through Facebook, text, and calls. My riches are not counted in dollars, but in everything mentioned above. I'm wealthy beyond words. Thanks to all and God bless," end quote. She seems like such a nice person, like a genuinely sweet person who's really grateful for everything she has.
Very warm.
Tim's dad, Ray, agreed and commented that they got a daughter-in-law out of their league, with Tim's mother, Amy, adding that Becky is a good girl and that's why she's so loved.
Becky's determination and resilience were truly remarkable. During her senior year of nursing school, she faced an unexpected challenge. She was pregnant again. And despite all the symptoms she was experiencing, she managed to diligently attend all of her classes, ensuring that she didn't compromise her education. That is quite impressive. I will never understand what it feels like to harbor and nurture a life form in my belly.
No, and it is incredible that she had the energy to do that.
Uh-huh. Becky gave birth to her third son, Arlen, during spring break in 2017, only missing a single day of school. Arlen was named after Tim's grandfather.
I don't think I could do it, honestly. I was supposed to take the bar exam when I was pregnant. My back was hurting. They wouldn't give you any extra time. I was like, no, thank you. It's too much.
Becky graduated summa cum laude and received the Faculty Outstanding Senior Award. Becky worked for Quincy Medical Group in gastrointestinal surgery before transitioning to Blessing Hospital's emergency room.
Now, that's a very demanding job, being in the emergency room.
Absolutely.
And she just had a baby.
Yeah. Those hours must be demanding.
It is. And all the while, she was equally dedicated to her boys. One particular Halloween, again, Halloween, they really liked Halloween, Becky went above and beyond to create an unforgettable experience for her sons. She used her creativity and her craftsmanship to build Transformers costumes that actually transformed. I've seen these.
I've seen some too.
And they're really cute.
Yeah.
So the joy and excitement was evident on her sons' faces. It was priceless. She embraced all of the activities that the little boys loved so much, even if it meant getting a little dirty. Becky joined her sons in fishing adventures, patiently teaching them how to cast a line and reel in their catches. Together, they explored the outdoors, they searched for frogs and other critters, and they created lasting memories together. She was the mom who would create those like first day of school posters each year with her smiling boys posing for their pictures. And she just loved being a boy mom. I don't know what it's like being a boy mom. I'm a girl mom. But I used to do the same thing and make Shiloh hold like the first day of kindergarten.
That's cute.
I mean, it's memories. It is really cute. And Becky's commitment extended beyond just playtime. She was the epitome of a soccer mom, never missing a single sports game, whether it rained or it shined. She was always there on the sidelines, cheering on her boys with unwavering support. Her presence and encouragement meant so much to her sons, knowing that she was there for them every step of the way. Even though it seemed like Becky had the perfect life, there was trouble behind the facade. It's true what they say. You never know what goes on behind closed doors. Tim and Becky were affectionately described by their close-knit circle of friends and family as a, quote, exceptionally loving couple, end quote, with Becky deeply involved in the upbringing of their children. Their unwavering commitment to their kids actually took precedence, possibly at the expense of their marital bond. Now, I have seen this happening. I'm not saying that this is exactly what was happening here, but many women who are extremely focused on their children, the husband kind of takes a back seat. You know, it used to be about being a couple. And then when the kids come, especially with young kids all in a row, it's kind of hard to have time for your relationship, even though it's very important. But I saw that in some of the Facebook posts and having her friends allude to this. I'm just mentioning it as something that I've personally seen in my own friends and family's relationships. It's a very demanding lifestyle with young children like that, especially while working.
Not as much as she was. Wow.
Exactly. It's hard to have that time for couple time.
Yeah. Got to make time.
But for whatever reason, there was trouble in paradise. What often went unnoticed to outsiders was the profound internal struggle the couple was enduring. And most people don't see what's going on in a relationship.
Especially on social media.
Exactly.
You only see the tip of the iceberg, right?
It serves as a stark reminder that what we see on Facebook and from social media on the outside can be very different than what's concealed beneath the surface. And if we haven't learned anything from what happened to Shanann Watts, I'm just going to remind you that social media is not real.
Everyone adored Tim and Becky. They were the couple everyone wanted to be like, envying what seemed to be the perfect bond. Tim had even said he expected to be sitting on his front porch in a rocking chair at 85 with Becky by his side. He felt that they had a strong and unwavering bond and felt positive about their marriage and their future together. It could be described as happy and a loving one. And this was the first 5 years of their relationship. But according to Becky's sister, Sarah, after the five-year mark, if Tim didn't get his way, he would become more controlling and manipulative. Their biggest issue could be traced back to when Becky decided to go back to school. When Becky decided to apply to nursing school to become a registered nurse, Tim immediately was against the idea. He's been quoted explaining the reasoning behind his apprehension. He said that he thought raising two boys with a third on the way would be too stressful for his wife. She was already extremely involved in their son's education, and he thought it would put undue stress and strain on the family. He also thought his family would suffer with Becky preoccupied with school. Becky's sisters saw this extremely controlling side to him, and when Becky wanted to do her own thing, he didn't like the new sudden lack of control.
That's tough, because you also do need to make decisions as a couple.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see how, I can see from both sides. I can see a woman wanting to pursue her passion because you only have one life.
Absolutely.
But I can also see how a husband or a wife, if it's vice versa, would be concerned.
Yeah. I would have thought that, you know, moving closer to Tim's parents' house, they would help out a little more, you know, thus alleviating the stress.
Well, there's something there that we will be diving into in just a moment. Sarah thought that Tim was worried that Becky would outgrow him and their relationship if she found career success again. Even though Becky took on a rigorous curriculum, Tim refused to spend any extra time with the boys or relieve his wife's time-related burdens. Despite Tim's lack of support, once again, Becky excelled in everything that she pursued, whether that was motherhood, school, or her career. Nothing could stop her. And that must have bothered him because he does seem to be insecure, according to what people said.
Wow.
Now, during the pandemic, and we know how crazy that was, Becky worked as a travel nurse at Northeast Regional Medical Center in Kirksville, Missouri, as well as Annable Regional Hospital in Annable, Missouri. In 2020, she was nominated for the International Daisy Award. The award honors exceptional care given by extraordinary nurses, and arguably Becky was an extraordinary person in all aspects of her life. In addition to providing exceptional care, she was governed by her compassion and empathetic nature. On top of being an RN, she was also trained to be a certified trauma nurse specialist and a sexual assault nurse. Certified trauma nurses are victim-centered advocates, and they support survivors of sexual violations. Their work is vital in addressing and mitigating the physical and emotional impacts of these traumatic experiences. They are the ones who examine women who come in after things like forced intercourse, and they have to document all of their injuries, and that can be a very challenging role, and it takes a very special person to be able to do it.
Despite her achievements in her career, Becky's personal life faced turbulence as her marriage seemed to unravel. Tim continued to struggle with jealousy and insecurity, which had mounted over the years as Becky achieved remarkable success. Somehow, Becky managed to effortlessly balance her career, her children, and her volunteer work, which for some reason left Tim feeling angry and resentful of the wife he once adored and imagined being with forever. This created tension in their marriage, and the two were constantly fighting with each other. Becky wanted to save the marriage and asked Tim to attend marriage counseling with her, but Tim refused. One glaring issue that Becky's sister noticed was Tim's lack of involvement in household chores. Despite Tim and Becky being responsible for maintaining their home, Sarah rarely saw Tim lifting a finger to help out. It seemed he expected Becky to take care of all household duties while he was focused on his interests. The lack of contribution from Tim created an imbalance in their marriage, with Becky shouldering the majority of the workload. I mean, geez, all that. Kids, career, schooling?
It is hard. It is. It definitely, I don't know. It's up to the couple because, you know, there are some people who want to do those things. My grandma never let us do things.
Yeah.
But then there are people who would like to share those burdens. Like, I'm definitely one of those people. I don't want to be doing everything.
I mean, we're like rarely 50-50. You know, it's like either 80-20, sometimes it's 70-30, sometimes 60-40.
Like it just like switches depending on who's busier.
Exactly. We're always helping each other out.
But it's also important to get other people to help as well.
I do agree.
I've had to learn that. I am not good at certain things, I have to let someone else take control of that.
There's no shame in asking for help.
Shannon, a close friend of Becky's, also noticed a strain in their relationship. During their conversations about their husbands, Becky often vented about Tim. She expressed her frustration with their situation, and Becky confided in Shannon, sharing her feelings of being overwhelmed and like she was carrying most of the weight in their marriage. Shannon felt like Becky didn't have a teammate like she did with her own husband, and that's tough. I definitely think it needs to be a team effort, and I always cringe. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure other people can do this too, but I see with men, they act like they're babysitting their own kids. You're not babysitting, you are the dad. They're your kids, and the chores and the kids need to be shared equally.
Sure.
Or it just won't work because one person will start resenting the other. It happens again and again.
I can see that happening.
Becky's friends and colleagues had countless stories of how she brightened their lives with her time, her energy, and her generosity. From dropping in to check on a friend with a migraine to dropping off a crib to a friend in need and staying to help her assemble it. She paid it forward with small gestures that had a lasting impact. She always found a way to highlight the achievements of others while never demanding the spotlight, which she actually deserved. Becky was described as selfless by her sister, and in her role as an ER nurse, you can tell that she went above and beyond. When she won that Daisy Award, a patient's wife had wrote in about her experience with Becky, and she explained that her husband came into the ER for what they thought would be an in-and-out kind of day. He had been bitten by a spider. It's pretty scary. And the bite was very swollen and causing him a lot of pain, and it was during the pandemic, so his wife was not allowed to come in with him. So after a few hours and multiple tests, her husband called, saying that they were taking him in to surgery and that she needed to come right away. He had gangrene and septic. That is actually very crazy and scary. That's one thing I'm like so afraid of, is getting a flesh-eating disease. When the patient's wife got into his room in the ER, it was empty and she lost it. She broke down. She started crying. All she could think about was that she may never see her husband again. But then his nurse, Becky, came over and said, quote, "Don't cry. It's going to be all right. They just took him into surgery, and if we hurry, we can catch him," end quote. So there they were, hurrying down the hall, and Becky told her patient's wife they could run if they wanted to. So half jogging, they went down the hall to the elevator, and at that moment, the doctors were just taking him through the surgery doors as Becky and his wife came down the hall. His wife got to kiss him and tell him how much she loved him, all because of Becky. The wife said, quote, "There are no words to express how grateful I am to her for what she did for me and my husband. She's truly an amazing nurse," end quote. And you would think someone as special as Becky would be cherished by her own husband and he would fight to work on their marriage so that he wouldn't lose her. But instead, Tim blindsided her on January 21st, 2021. After an 11-year marriage, he filed for divorce and full custody of their three sons.
Wow. It seemed as though he couldn't cope with her professional accomplishments and the attention they garnered. His feelings of inadequacy and jealousy grew, but Tim's biggest issue hadn't changed. This was his need for control. Even though he was the one to file for divorce, it appeared he still wanted to control every aspect of Becky's life. And most of all, he didn't want her to win anything from him in the divorce. That included their marital home, custody of the boys, and how she spent her free time. More than anything, he didn't want to give her any money. That would be seen as his ultimate loss.
I wonder why that is such a big thing. I always wonder that. Like, I'm always thinking, why can't both people just step away respectfully and realize, okay, this did not work out. We've created these beautiful children, but we're just not a match. And they're still both so young with so much opportunity ahead of them, so they could move on and have a life of their own. It seems so simple, but for many, it's not.
Right. I mean, both people just decide to create so much more animosity than just separating and saying, hey, sorry we didn't work out, but at least we got these three beautiful kids.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know. I don't understand how one couldn't be proud of your teammate. Tim himself hinted at a different explanation for wanting out. He revealed that Becky's behavior had undergone a noticeable change after she became a nurse. This transformation in her demeanor and actions ultimately prompted him to take a difficult step of filing for divorce. He said that she would lose her patience when it came to the kids because she was under so much stress.
I'm not actually sure what changed in his perspective besides the usual. I mean, of course, we get stressed, but it did seem like there were some people on his side. For one, his father, Ray. It appeared as though he sided with or at least supported his son's decision to call it quits with Becky. Now, interestingly, many people close to Becky and Tim thought the reason Tim filed for divorce was because of Becky's rule, and this is what I was getting to, that Tim's father would have restricted access to their sons.
Oh, why?
Well, it's a little confusing because we don't know all the details surrounding this issue. But what we do know is that Becky was able to obtain an order requiring Tim's father to be supervised around her children.
Oh.
While there weren't any convictions against Tim's father, several of Tim's family members allegedly provided statements about being inappropriate in the past with children.
Oh, that's sick.
Yeah, so I wanted to note that Tim's father has never actually been accused of a crime involving children, and there are currently no past or present criminal allegations against him. These were just things that were alleged, and Tim was livid that Becky would be able to control when and how his own father saw his children. It was one of the biggest hurdles that kept them from finalizing their divorce. But according to the court filings, they were fighting over everything, from money to who would get to live in the home, to who and how would raise their children.
In the months following Tim's divorce filing, Becky began confiding in many of her friends about how scared she was of Tim's behavior. In one text to a friend, she said, quote, "He has screamed in my face, he has shoved me in front of my kids, and has thrown things across the room," end quote. Tim's actions ultimately led to her filing a restraining order against him. In her petition, she accused Tim of entering her home without permission. However, Tim alleged that Becky was just mad about the divorce, so she was making things up about him that weren't true, like telling her friends he had an affair, which he did not, and then saying that he was an alcoholic, which was a lie.
According to him, right? Because this is always like a back and forth when you're in a divorce, and this was a very messy divorce at that moment.
He said, she said.
Exactly. And it turned out that Tim had actually filed a restraining order against Becky before she filed hers.
Wow.
So the court dismissed both of them because neither actions amounted to enough to actually grant the orders. But let me tell you what led to all this. May 9th, 2021, a few months after Tim filed for divorce, a text from Becky to a longtime friend, Nicole Bateman, she explained that Tim told her if she outed his dad, Ray, it would cause issues like the family having to move away to avoid criticism and judgment, and maybe something worse like his dad taking his own life, and it would be all Becky's fault. And she was scared that if she did come forward, Tim or even his dad would take the kids away and never bring them back. Then June 4th, Becky exchanged Facebook messages with a former coworker of hers, also named Rebecca. She was Rebecca Spots. And these messages went on again to state that Becky never wanted Tim's dad around her kids alone ever again. But she was afraid to actually file for that protective order because she thought it would trigger Tim to do something drastic. A few months later, in September 2021, Tim and Becky's divorce took a contentious turn when Tim sought the first order of protection against Becky, which we just talked about. Tim claimed that he felt threatened and harassed by her. And that's what led him to take legal action. As evidence, Tim actually recorded an encounter between him and Becky during one of their children's parent-teacher night at the school, which escalated into an argument. Now, I'm going to paraphrase his report to the judge. The incident happened one night during parents' night, as I said, at the boys' school. Tim said they got there around 5:20 p.m., and then he went over and he took some papers from his son's desk. And he was just going around the classroom, looking at the schoolwork. And he claimed that Becky came up and demanded a copy of the papers because she did not want to have to share with him. He said that he told Becky that he would make her a copy and get it to her, but she became combative. So he tried to leave. And then she came after him, following him out of the classroom. And then she cut him off, not letting him get by. He told her to leave him alone and get away from him. But this continued. So he stopped and he took a picture to document what was happening. He also took a picture of the paper so that he could send it to her through his phone. He continued to ask her to leave him alone. And according to him, now other parents were coming out to see what was going on and it was creating a scene. Tim said he felt uncomfortable and he continued down the hallway again. And when he got to the parking lot, Becky started yelling for the principal and grabbing Tim's shirt. To me, it looks like a normal interaction between two people who are going through a divorce.
Right.
And neither one of them wants to give in.
But all Becky's friends and family members said Tim began manufacturing incidents like this in an effort to limit Becky's time with her boys. They explained that incident at the school as Tim shoving a phone in Becky's face while recording her, demanding she stop harassing him and following him around. The short video didn't support any of Tim's claims. However, that didn't stop him from filing for a restraining order against Becky. His comments in support of the application are as follows. Quote, "She has harassed me through text numerous times, demanding to know where I was, who I was with, and what I was doing. So many times I asked her to stop harassing me more than once. She has been in my home and not left when I asked her to because she was causing a scene in front of the boys. She has stalked me to find out where I was and who I was with. She has taken the kids from public meet and public places." End quote.
The following month, Becky retaliated by filing for her own protection against Tim. This was after she shared her fears with family and friends over the many months following Tim filing for divorce. One of the nurses she worked with was apparently murdered by her husband, and this terrified Becky. She said that she had a, quote, literal panic attack, end quote, because she feared the same thing was going to happen to her between her and Tim. She said, quote, "I'm scared of what he might do and his erratic behavior," end quote. She added, telling the friend that her husband had taken her gun and her ammunition. Now, her sister recommended that she go get help from a domestic violence organization, and she did. And as a result, she decided to file her own petition for an order of protection against him. In her request, she stated she needed protection against harassment, physical abuse, and interference with her personal liberty. Plus, Becky asked the court to prohibit Tim from entering the marital home without her consent. When Tim first filed for divorce, he actually moved out of the home that they shared and into a house at 1641 Hampshire Street, which was only 4 minutes away from Becky and the children who were living in their marital home. It's quite an interesting looking house. I'm going to try to describe it for anyone that's not watching and only listening. It's a large two-story, five-bedroom, six-bathroom home. It almost reminds me of a gingerbread house. It's like a light blue color with yellow and dark blue accents. The interior is just gorgeous. It's very vintage. There's even a stained glass window and black and white tiling in the kitchen, which I love.
I do too.
But there were also some modern touches as well. And I'm assuming that he was renting this house and you'd think that he'd absolutely love being able to live there. But this wasn't something Tim was happy about.
He would often use the children as an excuse to enter the home that he and Becky had shared. He would let himself in and then go through Becky's things. He was looking for evidence of her dating another man and for legal papers she may have lying around.
Okay, so if he filed for divorce,
right,
why would he care if she was dating someone else?
Right.
That's another thing I always wonder, but it might be the thing of if I can't have her, no one can. Like if she's not going to do what I want.
Right, and it's also kind of like the ultimate control. I'm filing for divorce, so now I'm controlling.
Yeah, that's true.
Becky repeatedly asked him to stop entering the home when she wasn't there, but Tim felt like he had the right to enter whenever he pleased. As far as Tim was concerned, it was still his house and it would be again after they finalized their divorce proceedings. He would often enter the home when he knew Becky would be at work, claiming he was getting something for the boys. In Becky's application for the restraining order, she alleged that Tim had repeatedly taken property from a residence without permission. He entered her home without permission and is now using the minor children to access her residence when she is not home and without her knowledge or permission. She also accused him of repeatedly falsifying interactions with her and supposed witnesses. She claimed the protective order was necessary to protect her from further false accusations.
It's a lot, these reports and these things they're filing. They're very, like, full of legalese. But essentially, they're both saying the same thing. They don't want each other in the houses without their permission, snooping through things, gaining information from each other. And she legitimately had fears for her safety. That's right. What she said. And you've got to believe the person when they say that.
Absolutely.
And according to the petition, Becky also accused him of cutting down her favorite tree as punishment for not doing the things he's been asking for 10 years, and that he threatened to get rid of their family pet. And we know that Becky was an animal lover, so this emotionally affected her, as I think it would with anyone and their beloved pet.
Yeah.
We see our dogs as family members. So if that's true, that's unbelievably cruel. And it reminds me of last week's case. I don't want to say too much, but if you haven't seen it, there is some very disturbing things in there. But going back to Becky and her petition, she also claimed that Tim would argue with her if she wasn't adhering to a strict workout regimen and nearly hit her and one of their children with a garden hose and reel during an argument.
Wow.
Can you imagine arguing with your partner about a workout routine?
No.
That's pretty extreme and it seems pretty judgmental. I mean, we definitely want our partners to be healthy, but there are much nicer ways to get them to be active. And Becky was active and she was in great shape. And even if she wasn't, that's her body. And that's very demanding and over the top. But according to the petition, after she confronted Tim about these allegations against his father for doing inappropriate things to children, Tim simply told her to, quote, calm down, end quote, and not to worry because, quote, their children were boys, end quote. He made this comment in reference to the relatives of his who claimed they had been inappropriately touched. They were apparently girls. So he was trying to insinuate nothing would happen to his kids because his kids were not the gender that was affected. It's kind of an odd thing to say.
Yeah.
And Becky went on to write, quote, I could not believe that my children's own father was unwilling to take extra precautions to protect our children from potential abuse, end quote.
In an amendment to petition, Becky actually named several relatives and described the alleged inappropriate behavior exhibited by Ray Bleefnik. Two of the alleged victims were minors at the time of the incidents, according to that document. A third was 22 years old when the incident occurred. Becky also identified a fourth relative who reported witnessing some of the alleged incidents. However, the court denied both Tim and Becky's orders. As we explained, it seemed like he said, she said. The judge thought both parties were using the legal system to harass one another, which I feel like a lot of people do.
And they do. It is true. But you have to take it case by case.
Right. By November, a guardian ad litem, Rick Zimmerman, is appointed to the Bleefnik's divorce case to make sure the kids are represented by an unbiased party. And by the next month, Becky finally filed for an ordinance of protection against Tim's father, Ray. At this point, there was definitely bad blood between these two families.
Indeed. I mean, I would be worried about my children if that was the case and those things were true, but we don't know.
Right.
This legal action was initiated on behalf of her three young sons, aiming to ensure their safety and well-being. Becky had diligently gathered witnesses, like I said, and they were actually going to be prepared to testify regarding Ray's alleged history of perversion and inappropriate behavior towards minors, which had occurred several years before this. Now, however, despite this compelling evidence, the court ultimately denied Becky's request. The reason for this decision was because the allegations, they didn't meet the necessary criteria to warrant emergency protection at the time, because these threats had to be happening in the present.
Wow.
So things between Becky and Tim did not improve during their lengthy divorce process. Despite the passage of time, their relationship remained strained. And as the new year came, it was now 2022, and by March, Becky was writing her friend Christine Mandel, a former CrossFit partner, a Facebook message in reference to Tim. Christine had asked if Becky was safe, and Becky wrote back saying, quote, "I told you your jaw would drop. I feel safe right now. I'm super nervous for when this ends. If he doesn't get his way, he might literally lose his mind," end quote. Becky also said she had purchased a security system, again adding in reference to Tim, quote, "He wants everything. He wants sole custody of the kids, wants all the money, all the assets, wants me to suffer," end quote. And then she went on to just explain that she would rather let people just believe what they want and what he wants them to believe and just stay alive for her kids. And she said that it, quote, "sounds crazy to say that out loud, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that he would go off the deep end," end quote. Christine told her to go to the police, but one reason Becky didn't want to reach out to authorities was because she was fearful for her children. What would you do? I'm asking the audience. This friend was out of state. She wasn't close to Becky at the time to actually go and help her. But there are things you can do in this situation, but it is hard because many times people don't want to meddle. It's not their business sometimes.
Right. But just a few months later, it seemed that help was on the way. In August, the judge finally did intervene. He signed his own order. It was an order of injunction preventing both parties from contacting each other outside of an app used to arrange custody for high conflict divorces. The order also stated that during the times they exchanged the children, both Tim and Becky must stay within 3 feet of their cars. He ordered both Becky and Tim to attend a Children's First program through a company called Transitions. He allowed both parties to continue exchanging the children at their respective homes. However, he did instruct both parties to, quote, "only contact each other through text when it concerned the minor children, parenting time, medical issues, sporting events, school-related activities, and or extracurricular activities," end quote. All other communication was ordered to go through each of their lawyers. Most importantly, he ordered that, quote, "neither party shall go to the other party's residence except for the exchange of minor children, that neither party shall enter the home of the other party, nor shall either party have the children go into the home of the other party without specific permission of the party's home that would be entered," end quote.
Sounds reasonable and understandable.
Sure, absolutely.
Like, they both get what they want in a way, but from the judge's order, it appeared to Tim at least that Becky got more things that she requested in her petition than Tim received. The judge also ordered Tim to return a 9mm handgun that Becky had gifted to him when they were together. Seems reasonable. The gun is in her name, and if anything happened with that gun, she would be responsible, and she also wanted to protect herself. But Tim insisted that he didn't know where the gun was, and therefore he couldn't return it. He said he'd lost it and he hadn't seen it in the last 3 years. Tim's refusal to return the gun caused Becky to go out and purchase another gun for her personal safety. I would be so scared if my gun was missing,
right,
and the person that I was afraid of was the last person who had it.
I don't understand how you lose a gun.
I don't think you do lose a gun. But at this point, Becky had actually been seeing a new man, Ted Johnson. He and Becky met that year in January, and they became romantically involved in the summer of 2022. He was well aware that Becky's divorce was not going well. And he described it as, quote, very tense, and that she was looking forward to it being done, end quote. They were not in a committed relationship. It was more of a casual thing, but they did see each other often, like every other week or when they had time. It truly must be hard trying to get into a new relationship while you're still dealing with a divorce.
Yeah.
And it must also be hard to get to know someone.
Like while they're going through something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because they're not themselves. It's a very stressful situation.
You can't even relax, I'd feel. Even though 41-year-old Becky was finding happiness in various aspects of her life, she couldn't escape the impending divorce trial with Tim. The judge had set the trial date for March 3rd, 2023. Earlier in the year, January 5th, Becky bumped into a friend, Melissa Young, at TJ Maxx. Melissa noticed that Becky appeared mentally exhausted. They talked about Becky and Tim's divorce, and Becky confided in Melissa, saying that she felt like Tim could snap at any moment. She said that Tim told her, quote, you'll be dead before you get any of my money, end quote.
That's pretty disturbing.
Yeah.
And I also wondered just how much money that Tim was bringing in.
Right.
I tried to find out what he was currently doing for work at the time, and all I found was an article saying that he worked at Quincy Farm Products in business development, and his bio on X, formerly known as Twitter, says father of two, big boys, non-fiber marketing for Quincy Recycle, and owner of Q-Town CrossFit. And since it said two boys, I was guessing that that was long before 2021 when he filed for divorce, since Arlen wasn't born yet. He was born in 2017. So I wonder just how much he was contributing financially.
Sure.
It seems like Becky would be making a much higher salary in the field that she was in. But I also stumbled upon this very strange bio on his CrossFit page, and I wanted you to read it.
Okay. It said, quote, I have a magic hat. I am a wizard. Be careful when my magic hat flops over. I'm going to do something either amazing or angry. Which will it be? You never know. My pet jackrabbit is not lucky, so don't try to take his foot. He fires his poop pellets like BBs, and they sting and stink at the same time. He eats a lot of asparagus. My favorite food is bread made from bacon. How is that possible, you ask? If you don't know, then you don't deserve to ask. CrossFit, boom, end quote.
He's strange. I mean, that is strange.
Yeah.
And I did also see his TikTok videos under the name Large Man's Life. They're basically him after the separation from Becky with this long hair that he grew out, and he's sipping on a cup of coffee and offering like a daily joke. But I find none of them to be funny. I mean, you guys tell us if you think they are. But tell me what you think of this one.
I once got attacked by a whole gang of mimes. They did some really unspeakable things to me.
To me, he's trying way too hard to look cool and to be relatable. He's TikTok. I mean, not that it's bad to be on TikTok as like a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old, but and when he's like doing that gulp.
Oof.
I can't stand that gulp. You know when people say it's so funny, I forgot to laugh?
Yeah.
That applies here. I haven't said that in so long. It's so much worse than the worst dad joke. And I have that thing where I can't listen to people make like mouth noises.
Yeah.
But here's another one of Tim's funny jokes.
So at a party, my girlfriend told me to stop being an idiot. Just be yourself. I looked at her and said, you better make up your mind.
Okay, so he's calling himself an idiot, right?
Totally.
How is that funny?
Very witty.
And did you also catch the mug he was slurping out of? It said, I'm silently correcting your grammar. And here's one more to top it off, and it's probably the worst one yet.
Why did the Mexican man take anxiety medication? I'll wait. Think about it. Nothing. To help with Hispanic attacks. You're welcome.
Ew. The slurps? Oh my God. I don't know why he adds that.
I don't know.
I don't know if he thinks that's just like a funny touch. Maybe I'm just not getting it.
Yeah, I don't get it either.
Because we've both been called funny and witty.
Yeah.
And I don't think either one of us would laugh at these jokes at all.
I mean, he didn't even come up with them. Like, I've heard that when I was in grade school.
Oh, you did? I've never heard that one before. I'm late to the party.
It's okay. Now let's fast forward to February 2023. It's a month or so before Tim and Becky are due in court for their divorce proceedings. Becky's boyfriend Ted met her at her house on the night of February 13th and spent a romantic night before Valentine's together, before Ted had to leave to work the next morning at 5:30 a.m. on February 14th. On the week of the 19th, Becky was set to have abdominal surgery performed out of St. Louis. She was staying at her friend's house so she could take her to the appointment and pick her up. She stays until the day after her surgery, February 21st, when she returns home to her residence at 2528 Kentucky Road in Quincy around 12:30 p.m., where she's resting and healing. That afternoon, Becky texts Tim asking if he could keep the kids overnight for the next 2 days until she gets back on her feet. He agrees.
That evening, Ted picked up some food for him and Becky and delivered it to her house. He stayed for about an hour. He helped her carry some bottles of water and some books upstairs before leaving. He even helped her get into bed. He pulled the covers over where she was going to sleep, kissed her on the forehead, and told her to sleep well. Sadly, that would be the last time that Ted saw Becky ever again. However, the two did exchange texts the next evening on February 22nd, with Becky talking about doing laundry and paying bills. Becky told Ted she was free to drive the following day, and she texted, quote, "Pretty excited about it, LOL. Might not be comfortable, but I'm allowed to do it," end quote. The two exchanged more texts, and after about a two-hour break, Ted texted at 9:18 p.m. to Becky, quote, "Getting all your stuff done," end quote. Then he called her at 9:47 p.m., and they talked on the phone for about 26 minutes. She told him how she was feeling after her surgery, and she was excited that she was going to get to pick up the boys from school the next day on February 23rd. She was excited. She'd done laundry, and she was really sore, but she was okay. The very next morning, Ted sent a text to Becky at 6:41 a.m. that read, quote, "Good morning," end quote, but he didn't get a response. He thought that maybe she was sleeping in, so he texted her again at 8:30 a.m. and said, quote, "Hope you slept well," end quote. But there was still no reply. So at 12:39 p.m., he texted her Marco, and he hoped that she would reply Polo, but she never did.
There was someone else trying to get a hold of Becky, her estranged husband, Tim. Throughout the day, Tim attempted to contact Becky numerous times, but received no response. This situation became particularly concerning when Becky failed to pick up their three sons from school as previously arranged. Worried about Becky's well-being, Tim decided to reach out to her father, Bill, for assistance.
Bill gets what he thinks is a strange text from his son-in-law. Tim texted, asking him to call Becky to see if she was going to pick up the three boys from Tim's house because she failed to pick them up from school, so he had to go get them. Now, that text was sent at 3:03 p.m., and the boys get out of school at 2:45 p.m., so it seemed like perhaps Becky was just on her way, and she probably would have been to the school on time since not that much time had passed. But Tim made it seem like it was urgent, explaining that though they had planned on Becky picking them up, he tried confirming with her that day, and she never answered. Now, Tim lived closer. He could have just driven by to see if Becky was home, but apparently because of the restraining orders, Bill, who lived 20 minutes away, had to make the trip to see if everything was all right. He arrived at 2528 Kentucky Road at 3:30 p.m. The first thing he noticed as he approached his daughter's house was that the heavy wooden door wasn't completely closed. Becky had an alarm system, and the door was always tightly shut and locked. That struck him as odd right away. As he entered the home, he began calling out for Becky, but he didn't get a response. He walked down the hall towards the garage to see if her car was there, and it was. So Bill began to get an unsettling feeling. In a panic, he ran up the stairs towards her bedroom to see if she was just in bed sleeping, but the bed was empty. That's when he moved towards the attached bathroom. It was there he saw his daughter lying lifeless on the bathroom floor, surrounded by blood. It looked to him as though she had been there for a while. Her face and limbs were discolored. Hoping by some miracle that his daughter was still alive, he reached out and touched her arm to see if it was still warm. But rigor mortis had set in. She was stiff. When he tried to move her legs, they were also stiff. He wanted to call 911, but he realized that he left his phone in the car. He ran over to a neighbor's home where Rolla Wyke lived. He told her that his daughter Becky was dead next door and asked her to use the phone to call 911. After calling the police, Bill called his wife Bernadette, or Bernie, as they referred to her, to inform her of the horrific news and told her he was on his way to come get her, to pick her up and bring her back to Becky's with him. I cannot imagine getting a call like that. Your husband telling you that your child is dead. It's so heartbreaking.
Sarah, Becky's sister, was on vacation with her husband, Brett, in Florida when her mother called her. At that moment, Sarah happened to be in the salon and decided to let the call go to voicemail, assuming she would call her mother back later. Her daughter then urgently called and informed her that Grandma had called and was in tears. Sarah realized something was terribly wrong, and immediately she knew she needed to call her mother back. Finally, finding a moment to gather herself, Sarah dialed her mother's number and anxiously awaited for her to pick up. As soon as her mother answered, she delivered the devastating news. Becky was dead. She didn't have much more information at that time, and Sarah's world came crashing down. Without wasting any time, Sarah and her husband quickly made arrangements to fly back from Florida to their home in New York. Their sunny vacation had been abruptly interrupted by an unimaginable tragedy. As soon as they arrived home, they removed their summer clothing and bathing suits from their suitcase and exchanged them for funeral attire, preparing themselves to face an unbearable reality that awaited them in Illinois.
It's so true what they say, that your life can change in the blink of an eye. Can you imagine?
Absolutely. Especially being at vacation, being in the salon, enjoying yourself, enjoying your time.
And that's also so emotional to think you have your bag, you're taking out all your bathing suits, you're putting in black clothing. A lot of us can relate to that, having to just move quickly like we did when we had to go to Florida out of nowhere when my grandma died.
Right.
It's like you have no time to prepare for something like this.
You just go.
The police arrived on the scene shortly after Bill called 911. They were shocked at the sight of Becky's brutal murder. This type of violent crime was not common in this area. What they could tell right away was that Becky's killer broke down her bedroom door. The door frame was cracked, and there were pieces of wood scattered on the floor, along with shell casings. There were more casings leading into the attached bathroom. It appeared as though Becky tried to run into there and hide or get away. That's where she was shot to death. There were a bunch of shell casings scattered around her body. She was ultimately transported to the medical examiner's office, where Dr. Scott Denton performed an autopsy. As homicide detectives got on the scene, they began to recreate what they believed happened. First, during a walk around of the home, they noticed a patio chair that was pushed up against the wall on the outside of the house. A police officer demonstrated how he could use it to scale the side of Becky's home, and once you got onto the roof, there was a bedroom window that appeared to be pried open. This room belonged to one of Becky's sons. After the killer gained entry to the house, it was clear that he made a beeline towards Becky's room, breaking down the door and shooting her. It definitely appeared targeted. It wasn't some kind of burglary because none of the areas in the home were touched except for Becky's bedroom.
But their attention was soon captured by a curious discovery near the window, which the police believed was the point of entry for the killer. A partial shoe print was found imprinted on the ground in mud or dirt. The investigators carefully documented the shoe print, hoping it would lead them to a vital clue in the search for the perpetrator. In addition to the shoe print, another perplexing find awaited the investigators. Among the spent 9mm shell casings were several mysterious pieces of plastic. The investigators were at a loss as to why they were present and what role they might have played in the tragic events that transpired.
They carefully collected these pieces, determined to analyze them in hopes of shedding light on their relevance to the case. Then they found Becky's cell phone upstairs behind the bathroom door. When the detectives examined it, they saw that the last call Becky attempted to make was at 1:11 a.m. and 10 seconds to 911. She actually dialed 91126, most likely because the phone was grabbed or knocked from her hand as she tried to get away. This gave detectives a timeline. Becky was most likely killed shortly after she attempted to make this call for help. At 1:12 a.m., her ADT security alarm alert said that the front door had been opened. While the sensors recorded the activities, unfortunately, the alarm wasn't on that night. At 1:27 a.m., there was another ADT security alert that the front door was still open. Now that they had a time frame for when the murder occurred, detectives began going door to door questioning neighbors. They were specifically asking them if they had any video recordings from 1 a.m. on February 23rd. During their inquiries, the detective visited the Hyman family who resided next to Becky. Now, the Hymans had installed a security camera on the side of their home over a year before this because of a car break-in incident. Now, this camera primarily aimed at their driveway, but it was inadvertently capturing footage from the side of Becky's home. Now, unfortunately, the camera did not capture any relevant footage from the night that Becky was tragically killed. However, it did record something peculiar approximately 24 hours earlier. At precisely 1:05 a.m. on the 22nd, the camera footage revealed the presence of an unidentified individual walking down the Hyman's driveway, and they were heading towards the back of Becky's house. And then, just 48 minutes later, the same person was caught on camera walking in the opposite direction back the way they came. When being questioned that day, the Hymans tell detectives about an incident that their security camera captured a week earlier on Valentine's Day, the very same night that Becky's boyfriend Ted had been at her house. The Hymans initially believed that they had a prowler in the neighborhood that was kind of casing homes to see if they could break in. So they informed Becky about it. Now, according to Becky, she told them that she had heard what she thought was voices in her backyard and noticed that her motion detector light had turned on. Interesting. So they immediately wanted to locate Ted Johnson and bring him in for questioning.
Right.
Because he was there that night. There was a figure in the yard.
Yeah.
So they're thinking, who is this guy?
Well, he fully cooperated, giving them access to his phone and computer. He also gave them a sample of his DNA and allowed them to check him for gunpowder residue. He told investigators that he did spend the night with Becky on February 13th, just 10 days before the murder. That date is going to become important, not only because we know it was that night someone was caught on the Hyman's video camera, but we'll explain that later. First, the police aimed to gather additional video evidence, and they were successful in acquiring video footage from another house in the area, as well as footage from the Quincy Bus Depot. Upon reviewing these videos, the police discovered that a person was captured riding a bike in the direction of Becky's house. By carefully analyzing the recorded times of these videos, the detectives began to suspect that the individual seen riding that bike was the same person observed in the driveway. Because anytime the person on the bike was captured, someone would also be captured on the Hyman's camera. This new evidence depicted a person riding a bike in the direction of Becky's house both shortly before and immediately after the time of her murder.
Wow. So they were adding it up because they're like, okay, they were like, we see the person riding the bike.
And then
someone walking up the driveway. I love when they have footage. I love when they have technology. When they interviewed Rolla Weick, the neighbor who let Bill use her phone and drove him over to retrieve his wife, she told him she lived at her home for 47 years and she had met the Bleefnicks when they moved in 3 years earlier. While she talked to Becky from time to time, she rarely talked to Tim, describing him as aloof and unapproachable. Before Rolla went to pick up Bernie, she said that Bill called Tim and spoke to him again. While on the phone with Tim, Rolla heard him tell Bill that the school had called him and told him that Becky had failed to pick up the boys from school that day. He explained it wasn't like Becky to forget about the kids, and that is why he texted Bill and asked if he had heard from her. Now, the detectives reach out to the boys' school to confirm that this is why Tim was alerted that something was wrong with Becky. But they get in touch with Roberta Hudson, and she's the St. Peter's school secretary, and she tells the investigators that Tim had actually called the school that day at 11 a.m. And he told Roberta that he couldn't get a hold of Becky, so he would have to make special arrangements to pick up the boys. What was odd was that he told Roberta that under no circumstances should the boys walk home from school that day. Roberta told investigators that that was an extremely unusual conversation because neither Tim nor Becky had ever called the school before to tell them how the boys were getting home. Police found it peculiar that Tim would call Bill at 3:03 p.m., remember that? Regarding Becky picking up the boys, because by that time, they were already at Tim's house. He came to get them already. The investigators obtained surveillance footage from the school, and it showed Tim picking up the boys early that day at 1:50 p.m. That was 55 minutes earlier than usual, since the boys don't get out of school till 2:45. There was also footage of Tim in the parking lot driving his Honda CR-V. There were no other parents in the parking lot at this time. This meant that Tim called his father-in-law 15 minutes after the boys were supposed to get out and a full 75 minutes after he picked the boys up. That is very suspicious. And sometimes I wonder if people actually think about these things. Like, he didn't think the school was going to talk to the investigators, and there wouldn't be any videos of him. I mean, we know videos definitely are everywhere.
Definitely wasn't thinking at all. He's just acting. Once investigators speak with Becky's sister, Sarah, it only solidifies their suspicion that Tim Bleefnick had something to do with his wife's murder. Sarah and her husband tell detectives that as soon as they heard Becky was killed, they both knew it had to be Tim. Sarah tells them about a text message that was sent from Becky to both her and her husband Brett on September 4th, 2020. It said, quote, "If something ever happens to me, please make sure the number one person of interest is Tim, as that is who would do something to me. I am putting this in writing that I am fearful he will somehow harm me, come after me, or will do something to me that takes me away from the kids or the kids away from me." He already has lied multiple times to paint himself as the victim and me as the perpetrator, and it is absolutely the other way around, end quote.
Wow.
Yeah.
It is always good to have something in writing or right. text, anything to make sure it's out there. But it's almost like Becky's speaking from the grave at this point.
Right.
And this would probably be a good time for me to tell you about the autopsy results. Dr. Denton detailed what Becky was wearing when she was killed. She had just had abdominal surgery, so she had on one of those black surgical compression pants and surgical compression pads on her torso. Interestingly, this kept in a lot of her blood and added an extra layer of protection, but it couldn't stop the bullets from penetrating her body. Becky had been shot 14 times. She sustained 9 gunshot wounds to her torso area alone, but not all were immediately fatal. Sadly, Becky could have been alive for at least 10 minutes after she was shot. And that's just so scary and heartbreaking to think that she was lying there alone on that cold bathroom floor, slowly dying. And she wasn't able to move because she was shot twice in her back, and one of those bullets went through her spine and immediately paralyzed her. There were 3 more shots in her arms and 9 in her chest, 1 hitting her lung, 1 bullet entered the back of her hand and it exited through her palm. And Dr. Denton called this a defensive wound, like she was putting up her hand, yeah, on her face. He said that the mechanism of death was internal bleeding because Becky had almost no blood in her vessels. But because of the compression pad, he said it wasn't surprising that there wasn't that much blood on the floor next to her body. Denton said this would have been an extremely painful death. Let's not forget, a 9mm was used to kill Becky, and that was the same exact millimeter gun that she had asked him to return to her. And she was killed just 1 week before the divorce proceedings. Tim is, of course, their number one suspect.
Now going back to the evidence, the detectives have video footage, but honestly, it was really grainy. You couldn't really tell who the person was or whether they were male or female. Not much could be ascertained from the footage alone, except for the time frames the person was in close proximity to Becky's home.
However, they did take note that it appeared the bike that was used did not have reflectors on the tires. And usually, bikers want to be noticed in the dark, but this biker seemed to have taken the reflectors off, so they took note of that.
Then, on February 27th, just a few days after Becky's murder, the police made another discovery. They found an abandoned blue Schwinn bike near the Quincy Public Schools bus barn. Interestingly, that bike was found less than half a block from Tim's house, and it has no reflectors on the wheels.
Again, I cannot believe how obvious this is. If Tim's responsible, but of course they have to prove it. But come on.
Seems like it.
You leave a bike right near your house? I mean, I guess one could argue that they're being framed. But who else would have a motive to kill Becky?
Or at least the perpetrator lives nearby. Get this. As they're canvassing the neighborhood, another neighbor tells investigators that a month earlier, Tim asked if he had any security cameras facing the back of his home.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
I mean, who remembers Chris Watts? He kind of did the same thing. He was like asking his neighbors if they had security cameras, like pointing in certain directions.
Right. At this point, detectives obtained a search warrant for Tim's house and vehicle. It was executed on March 1st, 2023. He was standing outside with officers being extremely cooperative. But as nice and seemingly worried Tim was, it didn't stop police from arresting him 2 weeks later. On March 13th, that date would have been the date when he and Becky went to court for their divorce hearing.
Tim was subsequently charged with the murder of his estranged wife. Tim appeared noticeably disheveled and worn out in his mugshot. His hair was unkept, it was grown out, and it appeared wild. There was this deep-set look in his eyes, and it seemed to reflect a sense of exhaustion and despair. And Sarah, Becky's sister, shared her belief that Tim's disheveled appearance was a reflection of his mental state during the divorce from Becky, suggesting that his loss of control was taking a toll on him. However, Tim strongly denies this allegation. He said that he was growing out his hair for a cancer charity. Oh, he's such a hero. But after Tim was arrested for murdering his wife, a video clip of him went viral.
It turned out that back in 2019, he and his side of his family were contestants on the TV show Family Feud. It was him, his two brothers, Ted and Tom, his father, Ray, who you've heard a lot about, and his mother, Amy. They traveled to Los Angeles to be featured on the popular game show, and it became local news because they came from such a small town. Though it was recorded in 2019, it didn't air till 2020. And Tim was interviewed by a local news station, and he said that appearing on Family Feud was a thrill, and he couldn't wait for the show to air on Wednesday, January 22nd, 2020 at 3 p.m. on Fox, Illinois. He even threw a watch party at the local Reverie Sports Bar that day, and Tim told the news station he was kind of nervous about watching the show because they filmed for over an hour, but only 20 minutes made the cut, and he hadn't seen which clips they chose to use. Well, one of those clips definitely should have made Tim nervous, especially after being arrested on suspicion that he killed his wife. That's because he gave such a bizarre response to one of Steve Harvey's questions. Steve had asked him, "What's the biggest mistake you made at your wedding?" And after looking out into the crowd and saying, "Honey, I love you," he proceeded to say, "The biggest mistake is that he said, I do." You can hear his mother immediately react with like this weird, nervous laughter. Then Tim proceeds to backpedal, saying to Steve, "Oh, it's not his mistake. He loves his wife."
"What's the biggest mistake you made at your wedding?"
"Honey, I love you, but said I do." "Not my mistake. Not my mistake. I love my wife."
Then he said, "I'm going to get in trouble for this, aren't I?" And Steve is nodding his head yes.
"I'm going to get in trouble for that, aren't I?" Yeah.
Now, this clip was everywhere. It was all over TikTok and all over the internet, and everyone had an opinion. Even the contestants that he competed against at the time said that they thought that there was something off about him. But this is all going on after his arrest. Before all this, he became a local celebrity, making appearances on the news for his CrossFit gym, where he proceeded to take off his shirt and show everyone his body. He even made a cameo in a local theater production in his underwear.
What?
I don't even know what to make of all this, but he definitely looks like he loved getting all the attention. But all that changed when the attention turned negative and that clip began circulating. Tim denied any involvement in Becky's murder and even provided an alibi. According to him, at the time of the crime, he was at home with their three sons. Now, I will say that the Family Feud clip does seem very incriminating.
Right.
Here's this man who we know was having marital issues. He's on national TV, pretty much admitting publicly that the biggest mistake he made on his wedding day was even saying I do to Becky. However, upon further investigation by authorities, they found this clip to be a very insignificant part of the investigation. Because what none of those viral clips include is that Tim's answer was the second most popular answer up on that board. If you don't know how Family Feud works, it features two families who compete to name the most popular answers to survey questions in order to win cash and prizes. This show has been around for decades. It's actually become quite the icon in American television.
Sure.
Especially for its catchphrase, "Survey says," before revealing whether contestants' answer, like the one Tim gave, matches the ones gathered based on answers given to a 100-person survey panel. If you get a match on the board, you get points. So Tim's answer was actually on point.
I do.
The answers contestants give aren't personal. They're guesses about what other people would say. Yet none of the clips circulating explain this.
Of course they don't.
They just perpetuate the supposed foreshadowing of Tim's plans to murder Becky. In the end, it did appear to be just a coincidence. But that didn't stop this case from being known as the Family Feud murder. Whatever gets the public talking, right? But as for the investigation, they needed more than a stupid answer to convict him.
The detective suspected that Tim may have taken advantage of the fact his children were absent from Becky's home to commit this crime. However, the detective's investigation faced a significant hurdle as they lacked crucial evidence, such as a murder weapon or any bloody clothing belonging to Tim. In an attempt to find the connection between Tim and the crime scene, they decided to seize his shoes in order to compare them to a partial footprint found at the point of entry into the house. To their disappointment, no significant findings emerged from this. Furthermore, the detectives were unable to uncover DNA evidence linking Tim to the crime despite mounting circumstantial evidence against him. So they turned to Tim's electronics for clues.
This is my favorite part when they bring the electronics in.
Tim wore a Whoop brand fitness and health tracker. It's designed to be worn on the wrist. It's a popular brand known for its subscription-based fitness tracking system. Tim wore it consistently, even when he showered and slept. The Whoop wrist-worn device collects data on various aspects of your health and fitness, such as heart rate variability, sleep quality, activity levels, and so much more. It's designed to help individuals monitor their physical performance and recovery with a focus on optimizing training, sleep, and overall well-being. It's also connected to an app on Tim's smartphone.
It's kind of like our Aura rings. It does the same thing. It tracks everything.
Yeah.
Well, it would only disconnect from the app if Tim turned off his phone or became disconnected from it from a certain distance. So the police discovered in the past few months, the device was only disconnected and unable to track or receive data on two occasions. One of those occasions was at midnight on February 13th. That's the same night the Hyman security camera captured a figure walking along their driveway towards the back of Becky's house. Tim's Whoop device lost connection at 12 a.m. It's also the same night that video surveillance detected a person on a bike going past the Quincy bus barn heading towards Becky's house. That was minutes before the Hyman's residence alert notification showed a person walking up and down Becky's driveway. A few minutes later, the figure leaves and the person on the bicycle can be seen heading back towards the direction of Tim's house. Then at 1:10 a.m., Tim's Whoop fitness tracker reconnects to his smartphone, which had been offline for the previous hour. The absence of data during this time frame raised suspicion among investigators. The historical data for the device showed that this interruption in connectivity was not normal. There was only one other night where the same disruption would occur, and that was the night that Becky was murdered. Wow. Electronics solving the case once again.
They're tracking us everywhere. Now investigators believe that the 13th was Tim's first attempt at killing Becky. But Ted Johnson was at her house. He saw his truck parked in the driveway. Otherwise, most likely would have killed her that night in the early morning hours of Valentine's Day.
Tim saw that truck in Becky's driveway, and investigators know that because from 1:10 a.m. to 1:30 a.m., Tim's laptop conducted a search for a license plate lookup, a title and registration lookup, a vehicle VIN number lookup, and it searched vehicle records. The search criteria Tim was searching for were the exact license plate number and the exact VIN number for Ted Johnson's truck.
This was the same license and VIN numbers he searched after his Whoop fitness tracker reconnected to his phone. And the metadata showed it was taken the same night the shadowy figure appeared on the surveillance camera.
But of course, they still needed more. This is a lot. But just because an estranged husband wants to know whose truck is parked in his wife's driveway doesn't make him a killer. Well, detectives obtained crucial evidence by downloading information from Tim's phone. It was revealed that on October 10th, 2022, Tim's cell phone set up a Facebook account in the name of John Smith. He couldn't come up with a more creative name than that. That same Facebook account contacted someone on Facebook Marketplace about a blue 26-inch Schwinn mountain bike for sale. 2 days later, the same account contacted another person on Facebook Marketplace about a black Mongoose bike for sale. Tim ended up purchasing the blue bike, and one matching its description and picture was later found near his house. Even though it couldn't be tied to him through forensics, it did match up in all the other ways.
Now, let's dig deeper into Tim's Whoop ban on the night of Becky's murder. At 12:28 a.m., Tim's phone was locked. At 12:36 a.m., Tim's Whoop fitness tracker, again, was disconnected from his Wi-Fi and his phone. At 12:55 a.m., there was video surveillance of a bicycle rider heading southbound past the Quincy bus barn. At 12:57 a.m., there is more video showing the bicycle rider turning east on Becky Street. At 1:11 a.m., Becky attempts to call 911, but her phone is knocked out of her hand and is found behind the bathroom door. At 1:12 a.m., the ADT alarm records an alert that the front door was open. Police believe this was the killer leaving the residence. Minutes earlier, the killer, once again recorded by the neighbor's camera, headed towards the back of the house, and authorities believe he climbed up on the second-story roof. There, the killer, likely using a crowbar, walked past the master bedroom windows and kept walking further down the roofline towards one of the children's rooms, which were empty. For some reason, this window is not attached to the security system. And as many of you know, if you have a door or window that you frequently open, you can program your security system to ignore certain windows or doors from the alarm service.
I actually didn't know that. I didn't know you could program your alarm to, like, ignore one of your doors or windows, but it kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
And that window was opened by a crowbar, and later investigators found a crowbar in the basement of Tim's home. However, many people have crowbars, and experts could not definitively tie this particular tool to the marks made on the window used for the break-in. But it's likely that Becky heard this break-in, and that's what caused her to run to the bathroom and attempt to call 911. It took the killer less than a minute to shoot Becky, who was found face up, likely staring into the eyes of the killer just before he left. Just 1 minute later, the killer left through the front door. At 1:16 a.m., the video surveillance shows the bicycle rider heading northbound past the Quincy bus barn again, this time heading back towards where Tim's house is located. At 2:01 a.m., Tim's Whoop fitness tracker reconnects to his Wi-Fi at his home. At 2:07 a.m., Tim is awake enough to unlock his phone and do some early morning scrolling. Those timeframes are so incriminating. Between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m., a neighbor sees Tim bring a little Tykes basketball hoop to his dad's house. Now, they all live in close proximity, so he's walking this little toy basketball hoop from his house to his father's. And the timing of this is very odd because at the time, no one except for the killer knew that Becky was dead. And Tim's dad still wasn't allowed to have his grandkids at his home. Remember the order of protection Becky filed? Well, now that Tim, who authorities believe knew Becky was dead, made this gesture almost like an F you to her. Almost like, well, you can't stop my dad from seeing the kids now, can you? Which is just so heartless.
Tim was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of home invasion. Tim pleaded not guilty and refused to waive his right to a speedy trial. There are several strategic reasons to rush to trial. First and foremost, it puts pressure on the prosecution. Forcing a quick trial can make the prosecution less thorough. Often, forensic testing isn't even back for 3 to 6 months. But there are also risks to the defendant in choosing a speedy trial. A quick trial may limit the opportunity for plea negotiations or the exploration of alternative dispositions that might be more favorable to the defendant. A hasty trial might result in overlooked evidence that could have been discovered with more time and investigation. Tim decided the sooner the better. So just 3 months after Becky's murder, Tim went to trial on May 23, 2023.
We can't wait to tell you what other evidence was uncovered and revealed during this short 9-day trial with only 6 days of witness testimony. The state showcased over 200 pieces of evidence and had 46 witnesses. The defense exhibited no evidence and presented no witnesses. I really did not like his defense attorney. Mm-hmm. Her name is Casey Schnock, and she was actually Tim's divorce attorney, and then she became his defense attorney.
Wow.
And her defense was that Tim was innocent, and either one or more individuals were stalking Becky in the week before her murder. She claimed that the Quincy Police Department never followed up with identifying or investigating the complaints from other people in the area. She thinks the police got it wrong. She said that the complaints Becky made to her friends were just girl talk. She never saw any pictures of Becky with bruises or marks on her body, nothing to suggest that Tim was violent. I don't know if she was referring to seeing that person on the bike, but I'm pretty sure we established that that was Tim. And as for calling Becky's fears unwarranted because it was girl talk, I felt that to be really insensitive and kind of like gaslighting.
Yeah.
So we actually have the opening statement in video form and audio form. We're going to play one of those for you now or both. So this is Josh Jones for the prosecution.
The last minutes of Becky Bleeknick's life were not spent in the warm embrace of her 3 children, Deacon, Grayson, and Arlen. No, the last minutes of Becky's life were spent in fear, in pain, in terror, as she lay on the cold gray pile of the bathroom floor, slowly bleeding to death. Just a few seconds before that, Becky heard the upstairs bedroom window crash. She couldn't know, she didn't know that at that exact moment someone was prying in that window, prying it open with a crowbar. All she knew was that she was home alone. No one else was supposed to be in the house. Her 3 boys were supposed to be at their father's house, less than a mile away. She ran into her bedroom. She slammed her bedroom door shut. She frantically tried to dial a number on her phone. But that bedroom door was forced open. It was broken open. The door frame was broken. And the phone fell out of her hand. The last number that she frantically tried to dial, 911.
the door, forced open. She ran away. She ran into her bathroom, and she turned around, and she heard a shot. And she fell to the ground. She fell on her back, and she looked up into the eyes of her murderer. She looked up into eyes that she had looked into before, into eyes that had promised her once, till death do us part. She looked into the eyes of her murderer, her husband, the defendant.
Wow, that is definitely very emotional.
Very.
That she was staring into the eyes of the man who promised her forever, that's just terrifying to me. That's one of the darkest ways you can get murdered is by someone you love, someone that you thought you knew. And the prosecutor made sure to point out that he didn't just shoot her once or twice or even three times, but 14 times. In a chilling revelation, there was one wound for every year of their marriage, 2009 to 2023 when she was killed. And that is just so evil.
Absolutely.
But of course, the opening statements are not evidence. Later, they presented compelling evidentiary material linking Tim to the crime. They found 27 shell casings in Tim's basement, and these shell casings were identified as the same type that were found near Becky's body. The prosecutor also highlighted Tim's suspicious internet search history. They revealed that Tim had searched for various topics, including how to open my door with a crowbar. Can I force my door open with a crowbar if I lock myself out? How many cops are in Quincy, Illinois? How to make a homemade pistol silencer, average Quincy Police Department response time, and how to check if a gun is registered to me. He even searched, can you just wash off gunpowder residue? And of course, these interesting ones. Does my Whoop catch up when I'm not wearing it? Does my Whoop record while I'm not wearing it? Does my Whoop record the exact times I wear it? And what about how to clean gunpowder off your hands? And can you identify a shotgun shell was shot out of a specific gun?
My goodness.
Do people not realize that you cannot search these things?
I have heard so many cases where they check the data reconnaissance on what in your search history, and like right. All of these topics come up.
I search for weird things, but I'm not committing a crime, right?
Exactly.
Like I'm searching all these cases and I'm always like, this is questionable.
Yeah. The prosecution said that Becky sadly showed her vulnerability to her killer by admitting to Tim she needed rest after her surgery when asking him to keep the boys an extra night. He saw that as his opportunity, a weak victim, all alone, with his boys out of harm's way. He told the jury that Tim left the couple's three children home alone while he cleverly disconnected himself from his fitness tracker, thinking he had outsmarted the police and outsmarted Becky. He also explained that between the first alleged murder attempt and the second successful murder attempt, no bicyclist was captured again heading between Tim and Becky's house. He explained that Becky had witnesses lined up for their divorce trial to testify against Tim's father and to testify about alleged hidden marital assets. But Becky never got to have her day in court.
Now she would. And I think some of the most damning evidence, if all of that wasn't enough, was what the prosecution suggested, those pieces of plastic found near Becky's body. Remember those?
What were those?
Okay, well, they claim that these fragments originated from an Aldi grocery store bag. They found numerous bags at Tim's residence that matched up to the pieces. Like they put it together like a puzzle. The prosecutor presented the theory that Tim utilized these bags as a makeshift silencer, intending to suppress the sound of the gun or catch the bullet casings, and we know that he looked up how to make a homemade silencer. They even had a DNA expert that testified that the DNA collected from those fragments were more likely than not a match to Tim's DNA, so he touched it. The defense attorney claimed that the bags could have been used to transport items back and forth for the kids, and that would explain how Tim's DNA was on them. When the defense attorney questioned the state's witnesses, specifically Becky's own family and friends, she essentially persecuted them for not calling authorities or taking Becky's claim seriously. She was kind of saying, well, if you really thought Becky was being truthful, why didn't you do anything? And this left some of the witnesses actually bawling when they left the witness stand, and that was unbelievable to me.
In her closing argument, the defense attorney told the jury, quote, "You get to determine what the evidence proves and what the evidence doesn't prove. The burden of proof is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It is not based on conjecture. It is not based on getting divorced. It is not based on having bad feelings towards your spouse. It is not based on inconclusive lab results, end quote. As soon as the jury, which was comprised of 6 men and 6 women, were excused to deliberate, they began by taking a vote. The results were 11 in favor of guilt and 1 in favor of not guilty by reasonable doubt. Over the next 4 hours, they discussed the evidence with that one person until all 12 jurors were finally in unanimous agreement. They found Tim Bleefnik guilty of first-degree murder and home invasion. 6 members of Becky's family gave moving victim impact statements.
We're only going to play part of them because they are all long, but I will link them in the description box in case you do want to listen to them in their entirety, because I know a lot of you do want to do that. The first one was from Bernadette Postel, which is Becky's mom, and she sat right beside the prosecutor, Josh Jones, who separated her from Tim because he was sitting only a few feet away at the very same table. Here's that clip now.
I'm Bernadette Postel, the mother of Becky Bleefnik. When you murdered Becky, you took from your boys the person who loved them the most on this earth. You replaced their mother's love with emotional scars and trauma that will last their lifetimes. Becky's family, friends, coworkers, and patients will never again see her smile, hear her laugh, feel her embrace, or receive her love. We are left with emptiness that cannot be filled. We are only left with memories. Your soul is black with hate. Your heart has only love for itself. You should never be allowed to be free again.
Wow, that was so incredibly sad.
It really is.
And all of it is so true. Now, Brett Riley, who is married to Becky's sister Sarah, gave a statement regarding their 3 sons. Brett looked at Tim and said in part, and I'm going to play it for you.
I'm Becky's brother-in-law, Sarah's husband, Brett Riley. There are no words in any language that could accurately reflect the unfathomable impact that your heinous actions have caused, Tim. Did you think for even a split second about 5-year-old Arlen as you stood over his beloved mommy, riddling her helpless body with 14 bullets? Arlen, who cried in my arms the last time we were here, begging me not to go back to New York. Arlen, who profoundly misses his mommy and whose life is now forever altered in unfathomable ways. Did you think about 10-year-old Grayson as you charged down his hallway, chasing his defenseless mommy en route to slaughter his entire world? The person that loved him more than anything in the world. Grayson, who wakes up in the middle of the night, crying out for his mommy, who now will never come running to comfort him. Did you think about 12-year-old Deacon? As you broke through his window with a crowbar, climbed into his bedroom on your way to murder his mommy? First love, his loudest cheerleader at all of his ball games. The one person on earth that put the time in for him and his brothers, really put the time in. Will Deacon, Grayson, and Arlen, these 3 innocent victims, ever again trust the staying power of love? Or will they forever fear that their greatest loves could at any moment be taken away forever?
I was actually almost in tears watching that. It's just heartbreaking. I mean, it's so true. The people affected are the children. They really are. They're losing both their mom and their dad. Becky's sister Sarah gave the final victim impact statement, which was all about the 3 boys that he left motherless. She wanted to directly let him know that his own actions and internet searches led to his arrest. And this is that statement in part.
My name is Sarah Riley. I'm Becky's only sister. Becky's death was gruesome, painful, and senseless. You wanted her to suffer. You probably wanted all who loved her to suffer. And if that is the case, you succeeded. Losing Becky in any other way, infection, cancer, or a car accident, would have been tragic, heartbreaking, and agonizing. But this, imagining her fear, imagining her begging for her life, begging for her children, imagining her there, lying on the floor of her bathroom, paralyzed, struggling to breathe, and bleeding from 14 bullet wounds, praying to God in her last moments of consciousness to keep Deacon, Grayson, and Arlen safe from you.
In an interview given to CBS News, Sarah said that her sister thought of everyone who was in her life as somebody important and special, but most of all, her children were her whole world.
After the emotional victim impact statements, Judge Robert Adrian sentenced him to natural life in prison without the possibility of parole. He said this to Tim.
You practiced this murder. You broke into her house and you shot her. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 times. I don't know how long it took you to do that. Some of those shots were fired while she was lying on the ground. And you did all of that while your children were upstairs at your house, lying snug in their beds.
Wow. Okay, that scared me when he was counting the bullets. That was one of the best sentencings that I've ever heard from a judge. Right after this, Tim's attorney made a statement that Tim was, of course, going to appeal the sentence.
Of course.
Why wouldn't he?
When asked about Tim's appeal in an interview given to ABC News, Becky's sister stated, quote, "Tim will always assert his innocence. He was never able to admit fault or even compromise in life or marriage prior to this happening. I think that he truly believes that he is not at fault for this, and that's his own sick and twisted mental illness. But none of us are surprised that Tim is claiming innocence. He has nothing else to lose, so why would he do anything differently?" End quote.
She went on to add, quote, "It's still heart-wrenching on a day-to-day basis. We continue to move forward the best we can with support of each other and the support of our friends, family, and community. We are just doing our best. We lost Becky, but they lost their mother and their father," end quote.
Becky and Tim's children are now being raised by Becky's parents, surrounded by love and family members who have their best interests in mind. Sarah told CBS News that she wanted her sister's death to mean something. She wanted it to save someone else. She stated, quote, "Becky would have wanted positive change to happen. She would want someone else's life to be saved. If we can learn anything, if someone reaches out to you and says that they're scared, that they believe their partner or whoever it is capable of violence, you need to believe them and you need to make an active effort to make sure they're safe," end quote.
It is hard though, but I do agree. It's tough. It's a really hard place to be in. But if you do truly believe someone is in danger, try to do something.
Right.
But make sure you're safe doing it, even if it's just merely making a record by calling the non-emergency police department by their house, like in their local area where the person lives and where they're in danger, and reporting it. We want these videos to be a source of information to the public. So if you suspect that you or someone you know is in danger or suffering from a domestic issue, it's essential to seek help immediately. It takes many forms, including physical, emotional, psychological, and financial. Your safety and well-being are of the utmost importance. In the United States, you can call 1-800-799-SAFE. And many communities have local organizations, shelters, and services dedicated to helping domestic abuse survivors. You can find resources through a simple internet search or by contacting local law enforcement or social services, because it can save a life. Thank you so very much for watching yet another one of our videos. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the notification bell.
Yeah, thanks for watching and taking the time.
You never know when we're going to post. Should be a Monday.
Or Tuesday.
Could be Wednesday.
You never know.
So be here.
Bye.